Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
At a time when eating healthy seems to get more and more complicated and expensive, dairy remains simple and affordable. A powerful source of micronutrients, high-quality amino acids and calcium that are all essential for healthy muscles and bones, dairy really should be enjoyed as part of a varied and balanced diet. Lovingly made with all the goodness of organic British milk, Yeo Valley Kefir is a creamy, tangy, organic yogurt packed with billions of live bacteria from 14 different culture strains for maximum gut flora diversity. Available in natural, mango and passion fruit, blueberry and strawberry flavours, the daily boost you deserve is in the yogurt aisle at all the major supermarkets. To find out more, head over to yeovalley.co.uk. Hello and thank you so much for tuning in to Food for Thought, a podcast on a mission to equip you with all the evidence-based advice you need to live and breathe a healthy lifestyle. I'm Rhianna Lambert, registered nutritionist, best-selling author of Renourish, A Simple Way to Eat Well, and founder of Retrition, London's leading private nutrition clinic. In each episode, I'll be joined by special guests, all of whom can be considered authoritative voices in health, so that together we can learn fact from fiction and empower the healthiest and happiest versions of ourselves with trusted expert advice. When thinking about the future of how and what we eat, many assume that meat and dairy will be eaten in much lower quantities than what they are now. And it's probably safe to assume that the diverse range of foods we have access to would become even more expensive. But with so much emerging research, technology, and innovation surrounding food production and nutrition, have you ever considered that the future of food could evolve into something not dissimilar to a scene from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory? And knowing that we are all completely unique, will we ever get to a point where our perfectly fine-tuned diets really are as unique as our personalities? While much of what we hear about the future is all doom and gloom, I'm here with doctor, author and BBC radio host Stuart Faramund, who will talk to us about his exciting view of the future of food. Hello, Stuart.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, absolute pleasure. I know how precious your time is, so I thought I would start today's topic with the fact that already gaining some traction in the market is an area called nutrigenomics, which... To what extent, and first of all, what is it, and to what extent do you think this concept will govern how we eat in the future?
Well, I think you and I know that one person can have like a glass of milk and be absolutely fine with it, and another person can have it and they'll be all bloated. And that's because all of us, we're all individual and unique, and genetically we're all different.
Yeah.
And so nutrigenomics is all about looking at nutrition from a genetic point of view.
Exactly. And do you think that's something that will govern the future of our food?
I think I was at a thought leaders conference a few weeks back, and we were looking at the way in which food was going across Europe and how to kind of educate people better in terms of good nutrition. And this was kind of all the rage, talking about genetic testing and also looking at your microbiome, the bugs that are in your gut, in terms of tailoring nutrition for individual people. And so very much that is definitely the way that I think nutrition is going to be going.
Oh gosh, that's so exciting for me, especially in my field of work as a nutritionist. One day that's something to look forward to. I mean, how much do you think we currently know about the impact of our genes and how we respond to foods differently as individuals?
Honestly, I think it's not as much as we'd like to think. A lot of this was based off a 2015 study in Israel, where they looked at 800 people.
Okay.
They analysed their weight, their size, their lifestyle, did lots of blood tests on them, took samples of their poo to see what gut, what microbes were in their gut, put all that into a big computer, and then fed them different foods and watched what happened to their blood glucose after they'd had a meal. Mm. And the interesting thing was that they found that some people responded quite differently to the same foods. So you might have an ice cream and your blood sugar might shoot up. Mm. And somebody else, I might have an ice cream and my blood sugar might not change at all.
Amazing.
And so they pumped it into this algorithm. And then from that, they realized that they could predict what would happen to a given person based on their genetic and their and their gut bacteria, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. They pump all the numbers in. You can see how food will react in that person. You can predict. And they, from that, they reasoned that we can put together nutritional guidelines per individual people.
It does make a lot of sense if you think about it. I mean, like you said, when people can eat the same foods that on paper would have a fast reaction on your blood sugar levels or affect you in a certain way. But for some people, they're totally fine. And for others, they can't. It's a very interesting subject, but only 800 people, as you say. We need a lot more research there.
Well, if you look, there has been some research published earlier this year. It's been a 25-year project where they've been looking at twins and regular members of the public. This is in a UK data set. And from that, they found some really interesting findings. It's been done by an organisation called Zoe. I'm not sure if Zoe stands for something, but if you want to find out, you can go to joinzoe.com. Mm. And then you can actually enrol, because they're looking for people, 1,000 people to enrol on a sort of a try and eat stuff and see what happens to you. And we monitor you. So that was a 25-year project. And they found that even identical twins, when they have the same food, they might respond differently.
Mm.
Quite what that is, because if you're identical twins, your genes are exactly the same. So there must be something else. Maybe it's your gut microbes. Maybe it's something to do with your lifestyle. I mean, we really don't know. We are clutching at straws at this point.
Well, there's so many factors out there. And I think one of the reasons why I really wanted to speak to you today as well is that there are so many products on the market and they've got these big claims that they can tell us exactly how we should eat based on our DNA. But should we feel confident in these yet?
I'll tell you what, I went to this European think tank conference a little while back, and the company's there, and they were talking about, it's like the Fitbit of nutrition. It's customised to you, and it will tell you what you should eat, and it'll give you point scores for the different things that you're going to eat, and you can record them all, you can set yourself targets, and this is customised, personalised to you. And I sat there thinking, well, actually, that's cool, that's a really impressive piece of technology, but do I want to live my life by a smartphone app? I'm logging and recording everything. And for me, I think that's just a recipe for obsession. So, and I would urge a lot of caution, because they will take your data, they'll take your DNA and your poo sample, and they'll analyze it and they'll store it on a big database. And you've got to be careful what they do with it. And you also don't know how they're using, how they're coming to the conclusions that they come to, because it's all kind of corporate secrets, how the algorithms work and how much they really know to be able to draw concrete conclusions. And I suspect, actually, that the conclusions that they come to aren't as concrete as they might like to believe.
No, I thank you for saying that. And also, I might just throw in there that it's probably really expensive as well.
Yes, they tried to give... I had a free sample pack, which I think I had to send off a saliva sample. Mm. And I installed the app and started going, and I just thought, crikey, this isn't much fun.
There's only so much you can
there
get
There is only
from
so
it.
Much, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the way it's heading, but I think it's like all technology, it's down to us as to what we want to do, how we want to use it.
100%. I think it's just so important as well to consider the way that, you know, information is delivered to people using these products, because surely something as impactful as, you know, saying, oh, you have an intolerance to this product, you know, on one sheet of A4 paper, how does that affect people when they see that information?
Yeah, absolutely. And I liken it a lot to the whole genetics, home genetic testing. You can now send off a DNA sample and they will tell you what your risk factors are for breast cancer, dementia, diabetes, blah-de-blah-de-blah-de-blah. They don't tell you what those risks are necessarily. They don't tell you what to do with that information. So you find out, what, I'm at increased risk of testicular cancer. What on earth do I do with that information? Mm. And so I think, again, we've got this thing of where do the ethics lie in with sending off all this information, and what do we do with it at the other end?
And I think ethics is something a lot of people do not take into consideration. Well, it's not on their horizon, let's say, because as a health professional, you have a responsibility, of course, to consider ethics. but it must be, I mean, I hear messages a lot of the time on my social media platforms from people saying, oh, why can't I just buy this kit? Why are you not recommending this? And I'm like, well, it's really not that simple. And also, do you think we're going to see this technology and research adopted in the NHS one day?
Probably. I think, and people like the whole personalization thing. People like having, you know, we like having the Fitbits and we like having this thing that's personalized to us. And increasingly, medicine is going to get more and more personalized because, in the same way that food, medicines react to people's body differently. Not everybody will have the same side effects from a drug, for example.
Yeah.
You know, you might find ibuprofen is really good. Somebody else might find it does absolutely nothing at all. And so increasingly, it's going to be personalized. Medicine will be picked and tailored towards you. I mean, we're still at the very early days, but that's where it's headed. And I think that, yes, the NHS will adopt this personalised approach. And I think on a basic level, it's really important. You can't just take out of your recipe book, give to somebody, OK, eat that, you'll be healthy. It's much more important that you take on board their lifestyle, who they are, you know, what. And as much as we can, use the data that we have to personalise it to people.
Of course, I could not agree more. I mean, you've got someone's sleep regime, you know, not just what they eat and their activities, their cultural aspects, happiness even. We had a podcast on happiness recently, which was fascinating.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, small things that really do enhance our health that I don't think we consider a lot of the time. So as well as our DNA, we also know, and we've discussed, we've touched on the microbiome here and the internal physiologies that play a role in how we respond to certain foods. So what do we know so far?
Okay. The microbiome, which is the posh word for the bacteria that live on us and in us, in your gut, in your colon, your large bowel, there are more bugs in there than there are human cells in your body.
Amazing.
There are trillions and trillions of these bugs in there. And I'm sure you know this.
Well, apparently 2 kilos of what we weigh is the bacteria.
Wowzers. You can lose weight quite easily then by jettisoning those bugs. And they essentially eat everything that we don't digest. I'm sure you've kind of spoken about this lots of times before. But everybody's microbiome is a little bit different. And interestingly, people who are overweight and obese have a different microbiome. They have different bugs in their gut to people who are slim, which has led people to postulate, is it because people are overweight because they have fat bugs, if you like, in their gut? Do they have more? They have bacteria in there that chew up food and yield energy to you more freely than, say, a thin person. And so we can look at, and it seems to be that the microbiome is really important for overall health.
Yeah.
There is this interaction between the bugs in our gut and our immune system.
Or is it the chicken and the egg?
Exactly.
The fact
is it the chicken and the egg? does eating junk food change your microbiome? Yes, it does.
Yeah.
So it is that cause and effect.
You study that? That is tricky.
How do you study it? Yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely. So, yes, that again, like the genetics, we can use the, we're going to increasingly be using our microbiome. And it is, as I say, it's a really hot topic in terms of research. And in terms of, believe it or not, in terms of forensics, so there's so many bugs on us that there's been some studies that have shown that you can tell when somebody has walked through a room by sampling the bugs in that room. And you can even get a timeline of how long ago this person was in the room. In the future, like in a 50-100 years time, you'll be able to go to a crime scene and get your bacterial fingerprint and know when you were in that room. Based on the bacteria. It's incredible. We are just scratching the surface. There are so many bugs out there that we don't even know about.
My mind is absolutely blown. I mean, the thought of being able to solve crimes from our actual microbiome is just...
It's incredible, yeah. And so there is a lot of health to be gained by keeping a healthy gut.
Yes.
And as you probably know, is that when you have very poorly gut bacteria, there's increasing research and being used as a treatment of a rather lovely fecal transplant, which is putting somebody's healthy poo into your colon to repopulate it with healthy gut bacteria.
Yeah, I know, which may sound like you're kind of it's a bit squirmish, you know, but actually
it saves lives.
It's saving lives.
It does. When you've got an antibiotic associated diarrhea, when you've been in hospital traditionally and you've had lots of antibiotics, you've essentially, unfortunately, killed all the bugs, all the healthy bugs in your gut, in your colon. And that gives a space for the unhealthy bugs to essentially to proliferate and grow back. And you can end up with a nasty diarrhea called C. diff, Clostridium difficile diarrhea. And one way to treat that is to put some healthy poo back in there to give the good bugs a foothold to repopulate your gut. and bring back gut health to you. So yes,
gut health is just essential. I think we were speaking before on one episode about the fact that we are at a kind of fearful time where there's antibiotic resistance as well. We spoke with Dr. Tim Spector about flourishing the garden, he calls it, the gut. So, you know, put as much variety as you can in to help it flourish. And if we move away from personalization now, we know that by 2050, so 2050, the population is predicted to reach an incredible, here we go, 9.8 billion. I mean,
it gets beyond a point where you just think the number just becomes meaningless. I can't even think of a million people, let alone a billion people.
And 9.8. I mean, how well equipped do you think we are to be able to feed this many people, Stuart?
We're going to struggle, aren't we? But then I would say is that every time we have predicted that we're going to outgrow the planet, we've had technology that's come along and saved us. So we had fertilizers that allowed that we could increase the yield of our crops so that we could feed the rapidly expanding populations. And so I hope that we can do something to be able to use our resources more sustainably and more efficiently so that we can actually feed people. Because I think that we probably can, if we, a bit like climate change, we probably could do it if we actually all cooperated and put our energies into it.
Well, that's a whole different subject, isn't it? I could go off on that one, the corporation side of things. And I actually read a fascinating article you wrote where you explained how we've altered food over the years, like you just said about fertilizers, but through selective breeding to create produce that's kind of inherently different to how it started. So could you share some examples?
So I mean, one thing that really bothers me is about chickens and turkeys. So Christmas time, when you've got that great big plump turkey, that was once in the wild a scrawny little bird that was in the kind of jungle regions. And so over selective breeding over time, we've bred these birds to be bigger and bigger and plumper to the point that they're out of proportion and they can barely lift up, carry their own weight. Since 1960, the size of turkeys has doubled. So what you would buy in the shop, the size of a turkey. These are mutant birds, essentially. I mean, it's been done through selective breeding. We've not genetically engineered them. That's probably to come. So that is something. So the chicken breasts that you get in the supermarket, they are from birds that have been bred to be abnormally huge, grow muscles very quickly, and they're killed very young to produce this, which is actually quite tasteless, bland flesh, unfortunately, the meat. It's great for producing lots of meat and producing lots of profit. So chicken, that's one thing. I mean, there's lots of other examples out in nature. And watermelons, that's really interesting. Watermelons, they're great big things with lots of sort of juicy fruit inside. You have a good watermelon. But when you look back over history, they've been bred to be that big and be that fruity. They used to be a lot smaller and very pithy. There's some old paintings, some still life paintings. I'm trying to think of when it's back, but you can Google old watermelon, and you can see these paintings of still life, and there's a cut through of a watermelon. You can see that most of it is pith, and there's little bits of fruit in there. So over time, it's been bred, selectively bred. We've picked the ones that have been most fruity,
of course,
with crossbred them until we've ended up with these super fruits. Aubergine, it's called eggplant by Americans.
Yes, I know, it's my favourite vegetable.
Oh, is it?
Just throwing that out
excellent,
there.
Excellent, excellent. Do you know why it's called eggplant?
No.
It used to look like an egg on a tree, little white, little white thing.
I've seen different varieties. Obviously, there are many different aubergines.
Yeah, absolutely. So they have been bred to be the purpley things that we savour and enjoy now, that you love.
Yeah. Oh my goodness! When you first used the chicken example there, I got this kind of awful goosebump shiver feeling going down my spine. It really does make you think. In a way, of course, with evolution and adaptation, you know, things do change. But when you're describing things like this, and how does it affect the quality of the food?
Unfortunately, a lot of nutrients can be lost. You know, you go and grow a cucumber yourself in your greenhouse. It's small and piddly. But have you ever done this?
I have.
Yeah,
I have.
They taste.
In my
they
grandparents,
taste like
when
something,
they were around,
don't they?
They taste different.
They actually taste nice. Yes. And then you go and buy one from the supermarket. It's just a big watery thing. It doesn't taste like anything at all. And that is a reflection of the concentration of the nutrients and the antioxidants and all the goodies, the vitamins and stuff are in there. They're bred to be as big and as bulky and as possible and watery, because the heavier it is, the more money they can make. And so you've probably got a similar amount of nutrients, but they just sort of spread out over a over a larger fruit or vegetable. If you get up for heirloom breeds, then you can generally get something that is more nutritious. A lot of it depends on the health of the soil, because that's where the nutrients are coming from. And so if you've large commercially produced fruit and vegetables is going to have probably soil that's very, very drained of its nutrients. So yes, unfortunately, the nutrient quality of our fruit and veg has deteriorated over time.
And of course, not to worry people too much. So I still want to get people to get their vegetables and their fruit in.
Just an excuse to eat more. Just eat more of it. Yeah, you've got to. Yeah,
more of it. I think that is the answer there. But like we said, we've come up with this from a means of feeding more people. There's so many ins and outs, which is why education is so crucial here as well. And I think if we were to continue to do this, so continue to alter our food, for example, I don't know, by adding more nutrients to it, do you think that would be a beneficial option?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that we can look at technology as being the boo-boo thing, the monster that's going to destroy frankenfood. It's going to make our life horrible.
Frankenfoods, I like
frankenfoods, that's a great one. That's a Daily Mail one. Yeah. But technology has huge power to do amazing things. As I've said before, is that technology has saved us in the past, and I believe it will probably save us again in the future.
Yeah.
So golden rice, that's one way of putting extra nutrients into rice, of genetically engineering rice so that it has more nutrients in. And so we can breed and genetically engineer crops. Carrots, for example, they never used to be orange, but they were bred to be orange because, you look up in the history books, the person who I think was he Danish or something? You can look it up.
He
wanted orange carrots, and so they bred orange carrots.
I have heard that story.
And the orange is the carotenoids in them, which weren't there before. And that was just from a mutant carrot that happened to be orange, and so it was bred, and so it ended up with all the carrots being orange. Similarly, with bananas, did you know that all bananas are identical genetic clones of one another?
No.
Yeah, every banana that you go into the shop, they all taste the same because they all are genetic twins. They're all the same. They're called a Cavendish banana. And so they can only breed by reproducing themselves. So like Star Wars and the clones, you've essentially just got exactly the same thing produced over and over
again. I'll never look at a banana plantation in the same way. All the clones.
Which is a shame, because there's 100 or more different banana varieties and they all taste different. But we only have one. It's like only having golden, delicious apples in the shop. And in the future, we're going to have to incorporate more diversity, because this one Cavendish banana is at the moment under threat of extinction. I don't know. Did you know about this?
No.
Yeah, there's a fungus infection that is killing the Cavendish banana. They can't fight it with pesticides. Originally, the banana that they used before Cavendish, about 100 odd years ago, that was attacked and killed by a strain of this fungus. And so they switched to their second best, which is the Cavendish, which is what we have now, which is the great sort of cash crop. But unfortunately, it looks like the Cavendish, unless we do something, we genetically engineer our Cavendish bananas to be resistant to this, we're going to end up losing the Cavendish banana for good.
Unless that's nature's way of saying
more
Cavendish bananas.
Well, actually, I think it's a really good point. It's nature's way of saying, if you just make one genetically same thing and produce it to the nth degree, then you're going to come a cropper. And
you can't override anything. Oh my goodness, there's so many different
Bring
elements
back the diversity.
To this. Yeah, definitely. But you reminded me with the carrots, because I remember I've always seen, white carrots, purple carrots, but the orange just seems to be the variety that everyone would associate being a carrot.
Absolutely.
So if we were to add nutrients, that's obviously going to help feed the population, like we said. But what about, because I know you've mentioned before, potentially being able to avoid food triggering allergies?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a really hot topic at the moment, is allergies. And I would urge caution on all the kind of the home allergy testing kits and all those things, because it's one of those things that it's a real sort of hypochondriac's sort of paradise, allergies are. And it's very difficult to know for certain whether something does cause an allergy or not.
We have no means of testing it completely. We just don't know.
Well, the only way is to do an exclusion diet.
Exactly.
Just cut out everything, then slowly bring in one after another, which is incredibly difficult to do. You need a nutritionist to do it.
Precisely.
You can do kind of skin tests, but they're kind of a really rough proxy.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of research going into allergies in terms of what is it in the food that causes the out of proportion immune response. Your body is treating it like it were an invading sort of virus or something. And that's what is the allergy, is your body's natural immune response.
Yeah.
What is it that your body is falsely recognizing as a bad thing? An antigen is what it's called.
Yeah.
And if you can identify what that is, it may be a bit of a protein or something that the body goes, ooh, that looks like a virus to me, I'm going to fight that. If we can find out what that is, and there's a lot of research going into this, and people are finding out more and more the bits of the sugars and the proteins that set off the allergic response, then we can potentially breed or engineer our foods to not have that allergic stimulating substance in
allergic
it.
Allergic free nuts?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like,
yeah,
it's just, it's almost like an immunotherapy for food. It's incredible.
Yeah,
gosh, that's an absolutely astounding thing. And you've also mentioned some other really cool things, actually, when I was reading a lot about you. Mm. Things like ice cream that doesn't melt.
Yes, and also chocolate that doesn't melt.
Yes, the chocolate for
yes,
me, wow.
The powers that be are investing a huge amount of money in this.
Really?
It's very difficult. Yes, they're very shtum about all of this, but there is definitely chocolate that doesn't melt. Although, interestingly, if you have a flake chocolate... You know, I mean, I don't know how you can get them, if you can get them all around the world, but flake chocolates, try melting a flake chocolate and you won't be able to do it. Put it in the microwave, put it on a pan, it won't melt. It'll burn before it melts. And I've done my own kind of tests into this to try to work out
why it is. Well, I can see you in the kitchen now with all the flakes.
I don't know exactly why. I've had electron microscope images taken of the flake chocolate and compared it with normal chocolate. And I don't know exactly. I think it's something to do with the way that the sugar crystals are separated, or the fat crystals are separated more, to do with the tempering process of the chocolate. But we will have more and more of this stuff. I think that was discovered by accident, but they want to find more robust chocolates and ice creams that can withstand extremes of temperatures, because, for example, in the hot tropics, it's very difficult to transport chocolate without it melting.
Yeah, no, and I was actually going to say something very silly then, like, oh, why wouldn't you want your chocolate to have that little melty bit? But of course, it's transportation, it's getting it around the world.
On a hot day, yeah.
On a hot day.
In the car, you don't want it to melt,
no,
do you?
Well, of course,
that's awful.
When
you're back in the car and then you pick, and it's just turned to mush.
Do you know what's awful, though, is that I would eat the mush.
Put it in the fridge, let it set again, and then have a reformed chocolate bar.
That does not put me off, but I know it does my fiancé, so he is not a fan of that. Okay, so we know that plant-based meat alternatives are also gaining popularity, with one example being the Impossible Burger.
Yes.
What goes into this? How did we get it?
Okay, well, I think we're looking increasingly for meat alternatives for the future.
Yeah.
There's been UN reports all about this, and I think we all know that we've got to cut down our meat consumption and replace it with plant alternatives.
Meat and dairy.
Meat and dairy, yes, absolutely. Yeah, better not forget the dairy.
Yeah, no, I know. Yes. Bring that down. So, but this burger in particular.
The Impossible Burger, this one is made in Silicon Valley by the clever computer programmers over there who decided that they wanted to re-engineer the burger so that it was without meat. And they whittled down the thing that gives meat its meaty flavour is a substance called hemoglobin or myoglobin, which is like the same substance. It's the protein that carries oxygen around in our blood.
Yeah.
It's got iron stuck inside it. And so if you could get that somehow into a burger, then you could make it taste like meat. And that's what they reasoned, and that's what they did, and that's what the Impossible Burger is that they've essentially genetically engineered yeast to produce this natural substance that would occur in certain strains of soy. It's called leg hemoglobin.
Legume hemoglobin. Oh, right, okay.
So leg hemoglobin. So it has a redness, and it has a sort of a meaty quality to it. And you put it, and they produce this stuff, I presume they make it in vats, and then add it to the mix and put it in. And then they add it in. And so you have a thing that is containing lots of, so you've got all sorts of, you've got soy protein in there, you've got oil, you've got potato protein to bulk it up, a bit of beetroot to give it a red colour.
Mm.
And then you add this hemoglobin, this vegetable hemoglobin, and it gives it that meaty quality. So it's very difficult to tell. And yeah, huge amounts of research going into how do we trick the future of food will be a lot about trying to make flavours do fun and exciting things and, you know, teasing our taste buds in ways that I don't think we'd thought of before.
So much food science. I mean, goodness me.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
But do you really think that these foods are here to stay? Are they a bit of a novelty, or are they something that you think people get bored of? Because, you know, they might as well wait to have the actual burger rather than have a replacement burger. I don't know what you think
well,
the attitudes
are. I see
are.
In the future we're going to have two streams are going to be happening in terms of non-meat alternatives. So alternatives of protein sources that aren't meat, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how are we going to get that? And it's either we're going to have the people that are going to make the highly processed products like the Impossible Burger, and there are other brands available as well. But essentially, you look at the back of the packet and there's a frightening number of things in there, and you just think, crikey, was this ever food once? And it's this whole thing about processed food. Inherently, when we process food, we do stuff to it that means that often, typically, in a negative fashion. So, example for you, you go to the shops and you want to buy some oats, some porridge oats. You've got the standard whole oats and you've got the instant oats.
Yes.
You pick them up, you look at the back, the ingredients are exactly the same, the nutritional information is exactly the same, but the instant oats have been processed so that they cook very quickly, and actually they cause a big glycemic spike. Your blood sugars go up very quickly just because of the processing of the oats. They're exactly the same. So anything that's kind of processed will inherently have a change on the ingredients and the way your body responds to it. And generally, that's in a negative way.
Oh, yeah, even the bioavailability maybe. So perhaps we can, it's almost like taking supplements. You're supplementing food.
Absolutely.
But will that be as available?
The iron, for example, in cereals is not absorbed in the same way in which the iron that comes from meat and vegetables
is.
Of course.
And
so, again, you know, those recommended daily allowances of the fortified cereals have to be taken with a pinch of salt, because you actually probably need to have more than that in there, because the bioavailability, the amount that can be absorbed into the body is reduced so much.
Which is why I echo again, nutrition is complex and a science, and it's not as straightforward as you'd think.
It's not. It's very complicated.
It is extremely complicated.
It's very interesting, though.
It is fascinating. I think you've mentioned like the increase of processed, you know, and invented foods in the industry. Should we be worried, though, about some countries losing their traditions, those lovely cuisines?
Yeah, absolutely. And as I said, I think they see the future going in two ways in terms of the meat alternatives. We're going to have the people who want the processed stuff, the meat analogues, it's called, the things that look like meat but aren't really meat. And that's going to be the processed stuff. We're also going to have the people who want things naturally, because there's an increasing movement towards natural things that have not been processed. And for that, we're going to see other kind of ingredients. So we're going to have the insects, jellyfish. Do you know this jellyfish?
No.
Yeah, jellyfish. They don't taste very nice. They just taste slimy. But jellyfish, because temperatures are warming, jellyfish like warmer ocean temperatures, so they're becoming a pest in many areas. So if we can capture them, they're a great source of protein. They're nearly all protein and water. Jellyfish.
I can imagine it's like egg white, surely. It's like that kind of
It's kind of slimy. Weird. It doesn't taste them much at all.
No.
Wouldn't recommend it. You've probably got to do a lot to it to make
it taste good. Put it in a stew or something.
Other things like spirulina, algae, you can grow them in big vats. I mean, it's a natural product. It's a great source of protein. And you can grow all different kinds of algae to produce oils, to produce
proteins.
But just
to mention, those powders you buy on the shop shelves in the UK of spirulina are probably not the best sources of, especially it's not a source of B12, guys, because I hear that a lot as well.
Okay.
But they will contain some protein, yeah.
But in terms of feeding the world and the 9+ billion people that we're going to be feeding, I think we're going to have these big bioreactors stuck out in the desert growing algae, using, you know, recycling wastewater to grow algae, to grow a protein source that then can be skimmed off, if you like, and turned into food products that people can eat. I think insects is, you know, people know a lot about insects and lab-grown burgers and stuff like that. I think that's going to be a niche market in terms of the insects. But I think that through this, that we may be able to salvage some of the traditional sort of cuisines in countries. So like in countries where insects are eaten.
Well, yeah.
So that we can actually maybe relish those things. Yeah. And it can be something that's a bit cool because, you know, I mean, sushi became cool a little while back, didn't it? And so just kind of...
I don't know, sushi, insects, but I'm sure I could get there. I could definitely get there. What about 3D printing of food? Because, you know, I feel like there were printers that were all the rage a few years ago, but...
Yeah, I think you were saying like 5 years ago, 3D printers were the thing. And now you see, I thought that, but then I was chatting with somebody the other day and they said, actually, 3D printers are still around and they're becoming increasingly important because they're like 3D printing parts of aircraft and they're 3D printing houses and, you know, components of spaceships and stuff. The only way they can make them precisely is with 3D printing. I think, though, that not yet it's been something that obviously that we don't have in our homes.
No.
Because maybe in the future we will have one. Oh, no, my light bulb's gone. Let's just print another one sort of thing. Maybe. But, yeah, potentially there are 3D food printers. Any food, essentially, that you can put into a paste and can be cooked, you can put into these 3D printers. Obviously, there are different specifications to each one. There's at least 12 different 3D food printers on the market. And essentially, they will work like a 3D printer. So they produce a three-dimensional object based out of the thing that you put into it. So normally a 3D printer makes something out of like a plastic resin type thing.
Yeah.
But essentially 3D printing with food is doing the same thing, but with ingredients that are edible. You see a lot of these things done with sugar, so like a sugar that's set hard, and you get these very cool, weird-shaped candy treat things.
But what about the quality of the nutrition? I mean, if you're 3D printing, surely... I mean, do we know if that's then bioavailable once you've printed it again? There's all that.
There's one company that, I mean, I can't remember their name, actually, but they were going to use recycled food waste and then put them into these pouches. So like leftover vegetables and things like that, that you can puree up and you can put them into these pouches.
Yes.
That then you can load up your 3D printer with these pouches and then use it to produce like, I don't know, like a 3D pizza or something. So that's the idea. And whatever you can imagine, you could potentially make with a 3D printer. So gastronomically, it's a really exciting time. You go to Hessen Blumenthal's restaurant in the future and you will have some weird shaped, I don't know, potato that looks like a rocket ship or something.
Well, maybe it's the answer to my next question for you, which was about food waste, because we know it's a big problem. And in fact, we've got the estimated figure that 1/3 of all food that's produced goes to waste, which just makes me want to cry, really.
Yeah, when you look at all the different parts in the food process, I reckon it's about half is lost.
That's devastating. Yeah. I mean, do you think there's any innovation in that space there?
Oh, yeah, as I just mentioned. I mean, thankfully, supermarkets are doing this. We will sell you imperfect fruit and vegetable now.
Yeah.
Wonky veg.
Yeah, I love my wonky
veg.
And
I think that's good. You know, finally, you let us have something that is like grown in our garden. And it is a bit, you know, you've got a two-legged carrot or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're great.
Different sizes, shapes. Like we all come in as humans. Vegetables come in different sizes and shapes as well.
I think that, yes, there's huge potential there in terms of the food waste. We get stuck in this whole plastic thing as well because there's an increasing move towards getting rid of plastic, which I think is a really important thing to do. But by getting rid of plastic, so that cling film type wrap on your cucumber means that the cucumber lasts 2 weeks rather than 2 or 3 days in the supermarket. So like the plastic wrap Is important for some fruit and veg for its longevity. Huge potential in all those areas in which there is waste. There's going to be waste at the farm, waste in the transport, waste on the shop, waste in our homes. All those areas. That's huge potential for us to recycle that food, to put it back in, to repurpose it in some fashion.
It does reinforce, though, how many areas there are to consider. Like you said, the plastic, it is a big problem. But how on earth can we get to a point in the population where we're able to just cook fresh and not worry about having food in the fridge for so long? It's so overwhelming. And I think all the exciting innovations that we've discussed are, you know, they're very good. But what about climate change and the fact that processed foods and food production have an impact on the planet as well?
Yeah, this is very true. This is very true. I think, though, that it's worth bearing in mind that the future does not need to be a gloomy one.
Yes.
That actually we have huge potential to do really exciting things with food, and that food is something that we should really delight in and enjoy with family and friends and loved ones. And actually, you know, food, the potential to create, you know, like bubblegum flavour didn't exist 100 years ago. And now bubblegum is kind of, like bubblegum wasn't around. And you know, we have that flavour. And there will be new flavours that are discovered in the future and new textures and new sensations.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, for example, when we eat something, we taste it, we feel that we're tasting on our tongue. But, you know, if you hold your nose, then you can't actually taste it very well. And that is because, obviously, I've got an apple here, I'll eat it.
Nice. I love a sound effect of an apple.
So I taste the apple on my tongue, and I swear to you it tastes like it's coming on my tongue. But actually, all those apple-y flavours are coming from the nose, and your brain reconstructs that so that I swallow the apple now.
There you go. I'll let you swallow your apple.
Your brain reconstructs it to create this hallucination that those smells are coming from your tongue, and that is taste. Or that is flavour, rather.
Yeah.
And so by harnessing these things, by understanding more and more, we'll be able to create lots of wonderful new flavour sensations.
That was brilliant. I wondered why you bought the apple, and I was thinking that's going to be difficult to eat on a podcast. Like, that is such a good example. And it must tap into what I think a lot of people are talking about in the wellness industry in the UK of mindful eating, in the sense that people aren't really focusing on how they even eat food anymore. So surely that then affects the experience of enjoying the food and the digestion as well. If you're too busy working away.
I think we should bring back, make most of every opportunity to. Because food and meals are something that we come around together. There is there's a celebration. There is something to be discussed. You have it over food. It's always around food and drink.
Talking of a topic to be discussed here, the last thing that's the doom and gloom, but not really quite doom and gloom. Well, it depends how you listeners may feel about it. I also want to touch on Brexit. What impact do we anticipate of this joyful experience in the food
being
industry?
Well, being non-partisan, no political judgments made.
No.
The impartial assessments state that if we go through a no deal outcome of Brexit, so the UK leaves without some kind of trade arrangement in place, food imports will be more expensive. It'll be more difficult for us to have the variety of foods that we currently enjoy, and the food industry will find it harder. Okay. Food will become more expensive. Yeah. I mean, that all goes without saying. But I would say that the company that owns Cadbury's, the great, what's it, Mondelez?
Something like that.
They've decided they're investing in the UK for the long term. So they believe that Brexit or no Brexit, that is worth investing. And so the food industry looks pretty good for the future in the UK.
Great.
So fret not.
Yes.
Although you still might want to keep your Brexit cupboard of your toilet rolls and your olive oil and stuff like that for the day after Brexit when it all becomes very expensive.
Thank goodness for Cadbury's, eh?
Yeah.
Thank goodness for Cadbury's. Well, we now have some questions from followers now for you, Stuart. So Claudia has asked, do you think we'll all be vegan in the future?
Claudia, no, we won't all be vegan. But that's fine. We will increasingly becoming more plant-based, most definitely. And I think I've already said that already. We're going to be moving that way. But I don't think that vegan is necessarily the solution. I think that it's an important part of nutrition. There are things that you can get in meat and fish that you cannot get as easily with a vegan diet. So I think that there will be lots of more vegetarianism. In terms of veganism, we're not all going to be vegan. No, But I think it's a I think it's a great thing to do. You know, there's a part of me that actually thinks I wouldn't want to be vegan.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just think my wife wouldn't let me. And it's too much of a sort of a lifestyle change. I'm a bit of a coward, yeah. If I'm honest.
No, but you know what? It's very interesting because we have to take ethics out of it as well and just address this with, you know, the facts. And you're right. For some people as well, nutritionally speaking, it won't be possible for them to get the nutrition they need. Mm. And Esme has said, this is a really interesting one. Will the way they eat in space with powders work for us?
Well, they eat in space with powders work for us. Possibly. I mean, one of the things they're doing in space is 3D printing food. They're trying that so that you can actually create something that is more Earth-like in space. Mm. So who knows? Maybe it could work the other way. I don't know. Would you want a pouch?
I don't know. Huge respect for any astronaut.
There's that Solent. Know. Have you heard of that?
The what is
Solent?
That?
It's a meal in a bottle, essentially. Again, it's another Silicon Valley invention by a guy, really sad. He said that he didn't have time to eat, and so he decided that he wanted to make it as simple as possible, and he concocted a drink called Solent, which I think is based on some sci-fi novel, some dystopian future where there is some where people don't eat anymore, they just drink this thing. And you can buy it. You can buy it in cartons and pots, and you can make it up yourself out of powder. All your nutritional needs in a day in a bottle.
There is a similar product to that on the shop shelves over here at the moment. I think it was developed for a NASA program or something like that, and it's come over, but people are using it as meal replacements now instead, which isn't the intended use of the product, but very interesting. I thought you were going to say then something like a Willy Wonka type, you know, you could drink a roast dinner in a bottle.
Well, that'd be, I mean, I can imagine that in the future, that we'll have all sorts of, you know, like I was saying, in terms of technology and harnessing the mouth sensations and the things that go on in our mouth and the flavours and the aromas, and to be released in new and different ways and create lots of new experiences. But, I mean, do we want to... The thing about space food is that it's just a case of getting something up there to nourish the guys and the girls who are floating around in space.
Yeah.
And actually, I don't think there's much joy in that. So I kind of hope that we don't get too much space food down here. I like my fresh fruit and veg. Give me a Brussels sprout, please. Thank you very much.
Touch wood. I'll go for an aubergine.
Get your moussaka.
Yeah. Alan has said, is there a danger that over-engineering foods will mean they lose the original nutrition they started with? Alan,
yes, there is. We kind of, if you listen back, there is a danger. It can go both ways. You can, when you say engineering, I'm assuming you're meaning genetic engineering. A lot of the development that we do in food products is done through natural selection and crossbreeding. So you pick the specimens that have the thing that you want in it. Maybe it's particularly juicy variety, and then you crossbreed it, and then over many generations, you end up with your ideal fruit and vegetable. But you can selectively breed for whatever you want. You can selectively breed for the most nutrients. Mm-hmm. So in theory, there's nothing stopping us. It just happens that we've kind of selectively bred for big bulk produce.
Yeah.
So, yes, there is a danger of that, but there is huge potential as well to do good things.
Well, what a wonderful answer for Alan then. That's answered a lot. Amelia has said, this is the final question.
Okay.
I've been told I have a coffee and bread sensitivity by an online DNA nutrition company. Should I take this seriously?
My red flag is my siren is going.
Me too.
Oh my gosh.
My frustration.
No. Take it with a pinch of salt. Go see a doctor.
Yeah.
What they do in those genetic testing is they're looking for what are called SNPs, which are little bits of the DNA called single nucleotide repeats, are called SNPs. I might have got that not quite right. SNPs.
SNPs, I know what you mean, yeah.
So, and they're trying to match those up with people who have known conditions. And so sometimes they'll get it right, but really it's only a sort of a ballpark guess.
Mm.
It's a guess. So go see a doctor and don't necessarily take it as gospel.
Thank you very much. I mean, the amount of times in clinic people turn up with this big sheet of things that they've been told by test kits that they can't eat, and there is no grounding or reason why they can't. It's very, very interesting. But that moves me on to my favourite part of the podcast, which is our fact or fiction round.
Brilliant.
Are you ready?
Yes. So I have no smartphone to help me out.
No, you don't. So
okay.
On the spot.
I'll do my best.
So fact or fiction to the following questions.
Yes.
Not everyone reacts to sugar in the same way.
That is true.
Any food can be 3D printed.
Not true. And if you can make it into a paste, you can 3D print it. And yes, we do all react to foods. Yes. Ooh, definitely, yes.
Love
it. Sorry, I'm giving explanations. You don't want explanations.
Good.
You just want true or false.
This happens with every academic we have on. every meat has a nutritionally balanced plant-based substitute.
No. We wish it was. We will get there eventually, but no.
Love it. All food will be organic in the future.
No, it won't be, because you cannot mass produce organic fruit and vegetables in the proportions that you need to feed the world, unfortunately. No, yeah, as much as we would like it to be.
Goodness. There are taste sensations yet to be invented.
Most definitely. And I'm looking forward to them.
Yeah, me too. Homegrown food is more nutritious than shop-bought.
Not necessarily. It depends on the health of the soil, mm-hmm. And also as well as the variety that you're growing and the conditions you grow it in.
100%.
So not necessarily.
No.
It tastes better though, probably.
Yeah.
So do it for taste and
I
for
agree.
Fun.
A tomato at home is way better.
It puts you in touch with what you're eating a lot more as well, rather than getting it out of a piece of plastic.
So, yeah, we should do it. To have a garden.
I love keeping cucumbers growing in our greenhouse.
You should have bought some cucumbers in for us.
Yeah.
Okay, insects are the future of food.
In part, they will play a part. I think that we will see, as squeamish Westerners, we probably won't go for bugs very much. But when it's ground up into a flour and added to things for extra protein, we will call it protein-enhanced foods. We will go, oh, yeah, that sounds really good. That's really naturally protein-enhanced food. We'll go for it, not realising that it's actually insect power that's been put into it. So, yes, it will have a role.
That's so funny. We do not have enough research to fully trust nutrigenetics companies yet.
Correct. Absolutely. Top
exactly.
of the class.
Obesity is only a problem for developed countries.
So not true. I mean, Chile, for example, in Chile, they have banned cartoon characters on cereal boxes because 3/4 of the population in Chile are overweight or obese. It's become such a bad situation. They've had to put black labels, warning labels on junk food, on sort of processed food of like high fat, high sugar, high salt, in an attempt to sort of stem this obesity and overweight problem.
Oh, that's
so absolutely not. And unfortunately, as you were saying about losing the traditional diets of companies, it's happening because the Western world is invading everywhere and people want our burgers and all this stuff that actually is completely unsustainable.
Oh, goodness, we could do a whole other podcast
we
on
could
that.
Do, we
We've
could
got
do,
one
alas.
More question.
Yes, go on.
The future is a trade-off between global food production or state of the environment.
Wow. Do I get a thesis answer out of this one? So just ask that again.
Okay. The future is a trade-off between global food production or state of the environment.
Is it a trade-off? I don't think it's a zero-sum game, no. I think that both are targets. We can look after the environment and we can feed the planet. Oh. I am convinced of that.
Yay. Well, I really tested you there. Excellent quickfire round.
Thank you. Yes. Did I pass?
We throw tough questions in here. So that nearly wraps up this episode. But as with every guest today, we finish with a food for thought. So mine today would be that we've touched on some really thought-provoking and exciting concepts in terms of the future of food. And I'm so excited and a little bit scared to see these come to fruition, particularly ones that benefit the health, but also perhaps the planet too. So I'm particularly keen to see what developments will take place in the world of nutrigenetics and our understanding of how each and every one of us will respond differently to certain foods, which Stuart and I discussed earlier on in the podcast. It's completely fascinating how the human body works, and after all, my philosophy is always that we are completely unique as human beings, and I should add that our vegetables should be unique too, which would be something we should work towards.
Amen to that.
Exactly. But in the meantime, though, please remember that companies marketing DNA testing products still require further research to become the norm, and that qualified nutrition advice should only ever be taken from a registered nutritionist or a dietitian. Now, Stuart, if you could leave us with a food for thought or one thing that you think would really benefit our listeners, what would that be?
I would say that food should be something to be celebrated and enjoyed and let it bring us together and make us healthier and happier.
Oh, that was so beautiful. That was wonderful. Stuart, I cannot thank you enough for sharing your wisdom.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode, you'll absolutely love what's coming next week. So make sure you click subscribe to be the first to hear it. And please do leave a 5-star review. It really does help to get our podcast out there, to reach those higher highs in the charts and to help more people. For more information about my Retrition Clinic books, healthy recipes, events, retreats, and so much more, please visit Retrition.com and follow me at Retrition on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.